Hello.
Hello.
What's up?
No, just sitting on the floor
Oh, nice.
in my apartment.
Studio Deeson.
Studio Deeson. I'm
Beautiful.
refurbishing, so I have nothing to sit on, and I only have my waffle iron to heat up some food. So I'm just, yesterday I actually just put like a chicken thigh in my waffle. Let it sit there for like 20 minutes.
I mean, it sounds like college, right?
Never been to college, but yeah, I guess. So what are you doing?
Were making pizza, listening to cumbia,
What is
and
cumbia?
it's like a Latin American it's a Latin American genre of music. Started in Colombia and then kind of became popular all over South America and Latin America.
All right. Interesting.
Yeah. And that's what we listen to when we make pizza on pizza night because it's fun music and you can dance to it and it makes the living room or sorry, the kitchen feel like a very warm and inviting place.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. All right, so yeah, you're on the podcast now, Tim.
Okay.
Yeah. So
Hello,
this
everybody out there in podcast land. It's me from the introduction.
Here. You are the voice of this podcast, you know?
Well, one of the voices. I think you're probably the voice. Maybe I'm one of the tertiary voices.
So I'm just calling you up to use you as a sparring partner to introduce today's guest.
Okay.
I'm using you, Tim.
And I don't know who the guest is. Let's
No.
be clear for your listeners out there that this is an ambush of sorts. It's a welcomed ambush. I said I was allowed to be ambushed, but I wasn't getting any information about this podcast.
All right, so this guy, I actually have you heard of the Trail Runner Nation podcast?
Yes.
Yeah, do you listen to it?
I listen to it from time to time, yes.
Yeah. So there was an episode, I think it was in November 2020.
Okay.
They were calling up three people across the globe. I think it was Hilary Girardi, and she was in France. And they had Jamil Curry. You know Jamil?
I know Jamil's by reputation.
Yeah. And of course, he represented the US. And then we had this other guy. His name is Mark Agnew, and he's located in Hong Kong.
Okay, that name sounds super familiar.
Did you listen to that episode?
I didn't.
Okay. What he said in that podcast, just like, it was mind-blowing. Because he tried to explain to the listeners what the trail running scene in Hong Kong was like.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, so I just figured, why not just call up Mark and let him pretty much just repeat what he said in that podcast,
Okay.
so my listeners could hear it.
Okay.
But the thing is, Mark, he has some other interests that he briefly mentioned in the Trail Runner Nation podcast, and I wanted to talk with him about those interests, and that is, I don't know if it's called ultra rowing, but maybe it's called ocean rowing. Yes,
Okay.
he has attempted to row across the Atlantic twice.
Oh, wow.
And now he's planning to do the Northwest Passage.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
It's crazy.
It's crazy.
I'm afraid of the open ocean. Like it gives me a fear akin to the fear that I have being high up on mountains. It's worse though. It's much worse. So that's
Right.
terrifying to me.
Yeah.
Very terrifying to me.
Yeah, he's 28 years old and he's been living in Hong Kong for the last 7 years, and he is working as a sports journalist for the South China Morning Post.
Okay,
So he
wow.
writes actually about ultra running and trail running. That's his job.
For this newspaper that I haven't heard of until now.
It's an amazing newspaper. It's international. They write it's everything is in English. And it's one of the big ones.
Okay, cool. Well, yeah. I didn't, you know, ignorance here. I would have maybe pretended that I knew about it if I wasn't ambushed for this. I would, like, have done research and be like, oh, yes, the South China Post with the circulation of 5 million people globally published three times. Yeah, I don't know, but whatever. I don't know what it is, but that's cool. Sounds like a sweet gig.
Yeah. Hey, yeah, there's one thing I forgot to ask him about, though. It was, did you grow up watching Hong Kong kung fu movies?
Like, yeah, I mean, Jackie Chan was big for us.
Yeah.
For me and, like, my cousins and stuff. So it was Jackie Chan or nothing, really. So I didn't go, like, deep into, kung fu in general. But Jackie Chan was really big for us, which I believe is, like, Hong Kong kung fu.
Yeah, yeah, that was Hong Kong-based.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too. I think I watched pretty much all of his movies.
Rumble in the Bronx was, like, my favorite movie for, like, a year when I was 8 or something like that. We watched Rumble in the Bronx and we thought it was the coolest thing that had ever been created before.
Anyways, I forgot to ask Mark if there's still any kung fu movie production going on in Hong Kong.
Mark, if you're listening, you can hit him up at I don't know what your Instagram handle is off the top of my head, how to spell it exactly, but you'll find him, Mark. You can send him. We're going to talk about Hong Kong kung fu on another podcast.
Yeah, yeah. You can actually find Mark at the Adventure Agnew.
Okay.
That's his his Instagram handle, and he has a Instagram for his Northwest Passage project. It's called NWP 2021.
Okay.
And another shout out I want to give a shout out to as I was doing research for this podcast, I found a podcast which is from Hong Kong, and it's called, let me just open up my MacBook here,
Hong Kongulite,
because I found this because I found this guy who's, I think he's doing pretty much the same thing as I am, but in Hong Kong. He's like the Hong Kong version of me.
Okay, nice.
And he's got this podcast, and the podcast is called, it's called the Hong Kong Trail Rockers Podcast.
You are listening to the Hong Kong Trail Rockers Podcast. You will learn from experienced trail runners about their humble beginnings. You will learn from ultra marathon runners about their training and nutrition techniques. You will get life advice from accomplished individuals. And you will learn about all the beautiful trails we have here in Hong Kong. Without further ado, here's your host, Vince Neteri, with this week's episode of the Hong Kong Trail Rockers Podcast.
Nice. Shout out to the Trail Rockers.
Yeah. All right. Enough about me and the today's podcast. What's going on with you, Tim? Are you running these days?
I am running. I had a little season break around Christmas. I had sort of I have a chronic knee issue, so I try to take a season break every year when I'm sort of clear of my main goals. Last year was my first year since I've started running longer distances that I didn't sustain an injury, other than like falling and cutting my legs and then having to like let it heal over a little bit before I start running for a couple days. But like, it was an overall successful year for me, just in having like a good running habit, enjoying the running. I think I did one race, which was my first attempt at a 100 miler, and made it to 105 kilometers. So if it wasn't for the conversion to a different distance, then I would have made it. But it was a really good experience. It was a wonderful adventure in Rondona. But I somehow dehydrated and ended up with some gastro issues, but some coffee-colored urine as well. So it was quitting time for me. But apart from that, I just tried to run very consistently, have a good time, and I've carried that back over into this year. So running something like 90 to 100 kilometers a week, getting out to the trails when I can. But since we have so much snow and ice and stuff here, it's very slow going out there. So this is the time of year where I usually get a lot of speed work done on the treadmill. And that's not really happening because all the gyms are closed and I gave up my gym membership, I don't know, like 7 months ago or something. And so it's a little bit more road for me, doing some tempo runs, which I always struggle to do when full trail season is on because I would rather always be on the trail than doing tempo. And I like to go on trails that are a little bit fun and technical and stuff, so tempo is not always the safest way to run on those trails. But getting a little bit of tempo runs out on the road. And I did go skiing as well. I did not grow up cross country skiing. Yeah, I did not grow up cross country skiing, but it's kind of a must when you live in Oslo to get out onto the trails once a year. So I did my obligatory like one little like 1 hour out on the trails, and it's beautiful, man. It's a really beautiful sport or whatever. But if you ask me, you know, do you want to put on your boots and go skiing, or do you want to just like put the yak tracks on and get out on the trail, I'm gonna pick the trail like 99% of the time.
Yeah, I get it.
So yeah, that's kind of what I'm up to. Running, I have like one or two running partners that are part of my cohort because we're not supposed to meet as many people, so I'm trying to be very responsible with that. And so yeah, there's a couple guys that I meet once or twice a week, and just trying to get some good workouts in. And I don't really have any races or goals. We're having a baby this year, so I kind of like cleared the schedule on like 2 months on either side of the baby. And then we're renovating our apartment like 6 weeks after the baby comes, which I don't know, people just leave me alone about that. It's a decision we made. We're just gonna have to live with it. But I don't know when I'm going to be able to race again, not even because of COVID, but just general life situation. But I really found through this whole COVID thing, I don't need a race to feel motivated to run. It's just a great thing to do every day. It keeps you sane, gets rid of some excess energy, has me thinking clearer. And so it's good times out on the trails and good times out on those roads, snowy roads.
Awesome. Hey, you know I use Patreon, right?
Yes.
I'm not going to talk too much about Patreon right now. That's how I make a living. That's how this podcast is.
It's bankrolled, funded.
Funded, yes. And so I got this new Patreon the other day, and his name was Sivert Holmen. Shout out to Simon. And I Googled him, and it turns out he's really good at playing the violin, like the, you know, the Norwegian version, Haringfele.
Yeah.
And so I got in touch with him and I asked him if he could improvise and make a small jingle or something for the podcast.
Amazing.
And he did.
All right.
And so I think I'm gonna just start this episode by playing that that song. And then we're just going to ease into the conversation with Mark.
Beautiful. I'm looking forward to hear what Mark has to say.
Yeah, I'm going to send you the episode when it's finished. And I wish you had listened to it, because then we could do a debrief as well afterwards. Well,
maybe next time you have like a good English guest, then I can sort of just like secretly be listening the entire time you're talking.
Yeah. All right, so let's just start this this podcast, this episode.
Yes.
And do you have any last words to our listeners?
No, not really. I mean, if you're listening to the podcast, then I don't know. Have a nice time doing whatever you're doing, folding laundry, driving the car, walking your dog, going for a run. Just take a minute to smell the air and be present. And this is getting kind of New Agey, and I said I didn't have any words to say to them, but there you have it. That's what came out of my heart, and you just chew on that, I guess.
All right. Let's start this episode. Thanks for taking your time, Tim.
Thanks for talking.
All right.
See you, dude.
Bye.
Nå det alvor.
Hey,
Dan.
Hey, how's it going?
Oh, sorry, I was on mute there. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine, thanks. What time is it with you? Mid-afternoon?
Yeah, 1 o'clock.
Cool. Are you in Sweden?
No, I'm in Norway.
Norway?
Yeah.
Oh, awesome. I've never been to Norway, but I really want to go to Norway. I've never been. The coastline looks so amazing.
Yeah, I have been to Scotland, though.
Oh, cool.
I've done the, not the Ben Nevis, but the... what's the other one called? Glencoe.
Oh, yeah, near Ben Nevis. Yeah. Did you do a race there?
Yeah,
did
the Skyline.
Yeah. I only got into running since I left Scotland. But if I move back, there are a lot of things I need to tick off. And the Sky Race is up there on the top of the list.
Yeah. So how old are you?
29.
All right.
How about you?
I'm 32.
Oh, cool.
32.
Yeah. Have you been running a long time?
Yeah, I've been running, or not that long, 5-6 years. And before that, I used to be a speed skater. So
cool.
I went from being like a sprinter, huge guy, to running in the mountains.
Yeah, I was a rugby player. So
really?
Yeah. I weighed myself the other day. Like at the peak of my rugby career, I was like 17 kilograms heavier than I am now.
Wow.
But like not just fat, like I was a bit fatter, but I was like,
yeah, sure.
Bulky, big.
What about like, your powerful. Ears?
Oh yeah. I've come out with pretty normal ears. So lucky.
You don't have any cauliflower ear.
No. A lot of my friends do though. Yeah. One of my housemates, when I first moved here, each night, like for a while we'd have to like put a syringe in his ear and drain it for him. Luckily I never had to do it, but they'd like go into the bathroom and drain the ear for him every night.
So what brought you to Hong Kong? We have started the podcast, by the way. We have started recording.
We've started?
Yeah. I'm just cool. Sneaking it in.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to live somewhere apart from the UK. Not because I dislike the UK, but just, you know, I was just wanted to live abroad. Just graduated from university. I thought my rugby would be my ticket overseas. So I sort of applied to a bunch of like amateur, semi-professional clubs and eventually one got back to me in Hong Kong. They helped me out with a flat and a bit of money each month for the first few months while I looked for a job and became a teacher for just like 2 or 3 months just to stay settled here. Yeah, it could have been anywhere, but it just turned out to be Hong Kong.
Wow, but the UK has some ties with Hong Kong, right?
Yeah, certainly made stuff easy. You know, like I didn't need a visa initially to come here. I needed a work visa eventually, and you also needed a visa to play the rugby. But I could just land here and spend a couple of months looking for a job before I left, and which would have been more difficult if I'd got another rugby club would have replied in America or something like that. So yeah, that certainly made it easy. And also the big ties, so many Scottish people in Hong Kong. So I had like friends or friends of friends or people my sisters went to school with, or even people I went to school with, all like living out here. So there was a network like ready for me to like plop into the middle of.
I think there's some feedback or a delay or something.
It's working fine, my end. Do you want me to refresh or anything? Or
No, it's not all the time, but I can hear a little bit. But we'll be fine. So I had no idea the rugby scene was big in Hong Kong.
Yeah, it's like, it's not, it's just there's quite a lot of money in it, as there is in a lot of, in everything in Hong Kong. So they can like fund a relatively professional setup. Not that they were funding me, but they sort of all trickles down. And there's a lot of expats, a link with Britain. So I don't know. I guess in rugby in the UK, sort of this Premiership, Championship, National One, I would say rugby in Hong Kong is the equivalent of like National One in the UK.
Okay. What about the rowing part? When did you start rowing?
Also at the same time as I left university, my friend Stu sent me a video of people rowing across the Atlantic, something that I'd never even like heard of or imagined before. And we both said, we're going to do this very naively, because we never got our head around really how much admin it takes to get to the start line of that. You need money and contacts and sponsors, and it's just a 2-year full-time job on top of your job. So it took us a while to get around to actually trying it. But then I started rowing only so I could row the Atlantic. About 9 months before my first attempt, I learned to row.
Because
it's not that important. I mean, you've got to be fit, you've got to be robust, but you don't have to be that good at rowing. A lot of very good rowers actually find it very frustrating because they want to get their technique perfect. And it's a bit more attritional than that. And you can never really get your technique right because the waves and the swells around you can be 7+ meters high. So there's like one oar comes out the water as a wave drops from the left side of the boat. So you end up falling backwards and hitting yourself in the shin and that kind of thing. So it's not really like rowing. But certainly now I've been rowing for a few years, all with the aim of rowing oceans. It does help to know how to row a bit.
Of course.
An actual row would probably have a fit looking at my technique.
Hey, do you have a headset or something? Because it's only when I start speaking, there's this 1 second delay and I can hear myself.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes. Loud and clear.
Yeah, that should be going to the headphones.
Yeah.
Good. Grand. I've tried these before and they sometimes sort of cut out and then I have to reset them. But hopefully they won't.
Okay. So yeah, the ocean rowing part, that's a whole different podcast, I would imagine.
Yeah, but it's very similar to like ultra running and trail running, because it's such like an attritional sport. It's so much about the mind, and I've definitely benefited from having conversations day in, day out as part of my job with ultra runners.
I would imagine
finding out how they themselves. Yeah, I mean, what is. You know, I tried to row an ocean before I'd even heard about ultra running. And I just thought that was the limit of the limit of human capacity was rowing across the Atlantic. And now that I speak every day to ultra runners, even though they're not necessarily doing something that will take a month or two, the amount they push themselves and what they put themselves through has completely changed my level of normal. You know, the level of pain that somebody can deal with is just completely changed on my radar, because I just see people going through such lows and such terrible injuries. They might throw up and then keep going, or they might twist their ankle and keep going, which now seems totally normal to me. But 4 or 5 years ago, I would have thought, you know, even if I had been rowing an ocean, well, I won't row now because I'm throwing up. But now if I row an ocean, I'll think, well, you just got to suck it up, because I've spoken to thousands of people over the last few years who've run ultra marathons and just keep moving.
Yeah, of course. But the rowing part is quite different, because you have to actually make sure, because you have to get food, you have to get water.
Yeah, well, you carry all your own food. The water's made by like solar powered desalinators. So, I mean, the difficulty is motivating yourself to eat. You row for 2 hours, you sleep for 2 hours, you row for 2 hours, you sleep for 2 hours, and within 24 hours, anything but rowing and sleeping is so far down your priority list. You just can't be bothered to like boil the water and make the freeze-dried food. So it's about getting into a routine outside of the rowing. That's actually the difficult part. The rowing part is just simple. You just keep pressing with your legs. And then the water, yeah, hopefully the salinator is working, but it is like the one thing that's notoriously likely to go wrong. And then you've got to manually pump water through a salinator to try and make water. And that's such a massive effort on top of making the food. Not only have you got to boil the water, you've got to like spend 20 minutes just pumping water. And that can turn into an absolute nightmare.
Jeez. But you tried to row across the Atlantic twice.
Yeah, so in 2016, I tried and it was so bad. Like me and my friend Stu, I mentioned before, we found this guy on the internet. He was like, oh, I'm going to break the world record. I need a crew. Who's in? We signed up. We Googled him and we found a bunch of articles going back to the 90s saying Captain Calamity. And we asked him about this and he was, oh, it's just the press, like looking for headlines. And by that stage, I was so like emotionally invested that I completely blindfolded myself to all of the stuff that was going on. I could easily tell it didn't require a great deal of experience to just look at the boat and say, this thing is completely unseaworthy. Mm-hmm. But I was like, nah, it'll be fine. He knows what he's doing. He's built a good boat. He's done it before. And then we got 48 hours in barely, and we were in like 7 meter swells and the boat was coming apart. And yeah, we had to get helicoptered off. And you know, it didn't really matter to me because I just felt like it was such a monumental screw up. It was just like, oh well, how stupid of me. I shouldn't have got on that. I didn't put much effort in. Well, I physically trained a lot, but you know, I just signed up to this guy, paid him, got fit and turned up. So it didn't feel like I'd put much of my soul into it. And then, you know, you reap what you sow. But the second time I like spilled every single like inch of myself into the project for 2 years, getting it off the ground, paying for it, fundraising, training, learning everything I could, and changing crews and doing crawling inch by inch to the start line, and got there, and then it went wrong again, and that one really crushed me for like 6 months afterwards. I was just in like complete despair. I didn't think that I even would want to do something like this again. I wanted to row the Atlantic again, but I just couldn't even bring myself to want to, because it's such a huge journey just to the start line, and there's so many variables. It's so difficult just to get there. But I am trying to row an ocean again now.
Yeah, I've been doing some research and I saw your ballsy goals.
Oh, sorry, I can't hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Okay, we try again. Maybe it's your battery. I don't know. I think I was about to ask you about your upcoming project, because I've been doing some research and I saw your Instagram, and it seems to me that rowing across the Atlantic or doing big projects like these, it's quite similar to, for example, summiting Mount Everest. It's the fundraising part. That's like 75% of the job.
Yeah, certainly.
So could you get into the actual project and what the logistics are like?
Yeah, I'd say the Atlantic is very similar to that. It's like fundraising, getting to the base camp, which is tough. But this summer, me and some friends are attempting to be the first people to row the Northwest Passage, which is the Arctic route that links the Atlantic to the Pacific. And that's different again, because there's no blueprint. You know, at Everest, there is a base camp and hundreds of people climb it each year. So as long as you get to base camp, you know which direction to go. But we are trying to find out what base camp is. We're trying to design base camp before we even try and climb in this metaphor. So this has been a whole different ball game in terms of logistics. For a start, the fundamental thing is fundraising, which in the time of coronavirus is incredibly difficult.
Oh yeah.
So it's about reaching out to people, trying to get them to like buy into the message and understand that this world first is going to garner a lot of press. So it's not like a risk per se. It's like you're guaranteed press. and also trying to get our credentials across to them. Obviously, I haven't rowed the Atlantic, but everybody else in the crew basically has rowed the Atlantic at least. Some of them have rowed multiple oceans, got records. So trying to get them to understand, like, if any team's going to do it, then it's us. We are super experienced. One flip side of coronavirus, although fundraising is very difficult, but it's always difficult, is documentary makers don't have much to film. So suddenly we have like a lot of interest from big production companies, which can help. But I would describe the to just summarize, like, the logistical process, it is basically having the mental strength to keep going despite getting no after no after no, because eventually you will get a yes. A lot of people ask me for advice, like, who are trying to row the Atlantic themselves, or I ask people for advice, and they always have the same thing. There's no silver bullet. Somebody might give you a different opinion about how to word an email, or a different opinion about what sponsorship deck to send over. It's just about, like, relentlessly chasing it until eventually you get a yes.
I read the book by, you know, Nimstai, right? The guy who did the Project Possible. Climbed all the 8,000 meter peaks in how many months? Yeah. 6-7 months?
Something like that.
Yeah. And he spoke a lot about the fundraising. And one of the things he did, he partnered up with a watch brand. I think it was
Braymont. Is it Braymont?
Yeah, something like that. And I think deal was that he was going to bring one watch up to each peak, and they were going to sell every single watch, and it would represent each peak or something. Mm-hmm. So have you come up with a similar plan or something genius like that?
Well, Braymont is the watch that sponsored him, and I'm actually becoming an ambassador for them, although over Christmas and Chinese New Year, they begin to drag their feet about giving me my watch. But it is about being creative. And that's a pretty cool idea that he came up with. What we came up with was a gin, like a, people keep think I'm saying gin, like a gin and tonic.
Yes.
So we produced our own gin bottle with the help of a Orkney distillery. And the thing about Orkney is about 80-90% of the Hudson Bay Company came from Orkney. All their employees and even their senior staff were people from Orkney, and they mapped.
Where is Orkney?
Orkney is his islands off the north coast of Scotland.
Okay.
Ships would leave London, go up the east coast of Britain, stop in Orkney, like, get up with food and water, then head across the Hudson Bay to trap fur and accidentally map the whole thing and find a route. So we made it up there with botanicals from the Hudson Bay and the Northwest Passage in Orkney, and also with water from a well there that Captain Cook used before he went to explore the Northwest Passage.
Oh, cool.
So it's about building this whole story, and it is a lovely gin. I really enjoy it, but it's more about, like,
the story,
getting the message across there. Like, people can really buy into this cool story via this gin, which is a creative project, I suppose, a unique way of trying to raise funds and awareness.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right, so I think we're going to have to pick this up in another podcast, maybe after you completed the,
the project. Yeah, absolutely.
That'd be interesting. So let's get into some trail running, because I know my listeners, they want to hear about the trails in Hong Kong and what it's like over there, the whole scene. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm just getting a bit of feedback on my end now.
Okay. So yeah, the trail running scene in Hong Kong. You're a journalist in the South China Morning Post, and I think one of my first questions about this is, when you came to Hong Kong, how difficult was it to get to know the community?
When I first came to Hong Kong, I knew nothing about trail running. It took me 3 or 4 years of being here before I got my job at the SCMP, but everybody hears of the Oxfam Trail Walker. So my first introduction to trail running was by my girlfriend at the time, now fiance, who ran the Oxfam Trail Walker. Oxfam Trail Walker is a 100K race, takes place in November each year in Hong Kong in teams of four. It's not a relay. You run the whole thing with your team of four. Even at the time, I hadn't heard terms like ultra marathon or trail run. You know, we just referred to it as sort of like a hiking running race. that would take hopefully her less than 24 hours. Years later, I was like, oh, you know, you ran an ultra marathon. Oh, did I? Cool. We'd never heard those kind of terms. Yeah, that was my first introduction. And that is a lot of people's introduction to trail running in Hong Kong. It's either via the Oxfam Trail Walker or the Barclays Moon Trekker. Those are the two popular races that even non-trail runners have heard of. But then I found out about trail running by my job. I basically got employed to write about it. And I thought, oh, okay, I'm employed to write about the Oxfam Trail Walker and the Moon Trekker. But then I found out that there are races every single weekend. That was a tip of the iceberg.
So, yeah, I listened to a podcast where you were interviewed, and I think you said that you have 217 races in Hong Kong every year, and most of them are between October and March.
Yeah, that was in an article a couple of years ago written by my colleague Mary Hui, and the amount of races may well have gone up. Well, this year that they've completely ceased. That was the amount of that grants, the amount of grants. What do you call them? Like the people who run the country parks allowed 217 races at least a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And yeah, every weekend in October or November, I could just scroll through any website or trail running calendar and just pick from several races. If I wanted to do a 25K race on Hong Kong Island or a 100K race up in the New Territories or like a family hike and lunch race down on Lantau Island, whatever, there is everything going on every single weekend.
Jeez, but the city is not that big, right?
Like, well, 7 million people.
Yeah, but the actual area is not that big.
Yeah, a lot of that is a problem. A lot of the trail races are now sort of just going through variations of each other.
Mm.
there are a lot of trails, but the government is only allows them on what they call named trails, like official trails that they like maintain to stop erosion and for other safety reasons. But it does mean that like there can be a race this way down one trail and backwards the next weekend and across it the weekend afterwards and backwards and forwards the weekend after that. So it is it can be difficult, but there are races that are trying to come up with like unique ways of linking up the same trails to offer new kind of races.
Yeah, like the one you called the Four Trails.
Oh yeah, well that's not a race. The organizer makes it very clear it's an event. Nobody wins or loses. It's a personal challenge. But that is
okay.
That's amazing.
So can you try amazing. And describe the Four Trails?
So there are four major trails in Hong Kong. The Macklehose Trail, which is 100 kilometers. The Wilson Trail, 78. The Hong Kong Trail is 50K. And the Lantau Trail is 78K. Oh, no, 70K, sorry. And the Four Trails links all four of them. And there's no checkpoints, there's no support allowed on the trails, but the runners are allowed a bit of help getting between the trails. So once they finish the 100K Macklehose, their friends drive them to the start of the Wilson. And they have to finish it in under 60 hours to be a finisher, or under 72 hours to be a survivor. It's been going for 10 years. This February is the 10-year anniversary. There's only been 16 finishers in total.
That's just like the Barclays.
Yeah, it's like the Barclays. That people do compare it to the Barclays a lot. I think it is different because it lacks maybe the element of the orienteering that the Barclays has, but it is so hard. Like the 60 hours, it's actually really fast. Like, you know, for all the interviews you do, you hear about mental strength, having to dig deep, push yourself, but you actually also have to be a serious athlete, trained and able to move very quickly just to finish. Like, it's not just about, you can't think your way through it.
Mm.
So these guys are serious runners, at least the ones who get to the end. The 100K, the Macklehose has a cutoff of 18 hours. And to give that context, me, I'm like fit, but also pretty average. I could do the Macklehose in probably 24 hours. So the cutoff for the first 100K is like 18 hours. And then you've got to do a subsequent 198K. And the elevation is 14,000 meters. It's crazy. It's so cool. I love it because it's just so simple and basic, and it's only 20 people, 30 people a year.
I saw a video on YouTube, and of course, I'm not 100% sure about Hong Kong, but it looks like it's a peninsula, and then you have two islands outside of that. And
yeah, so Hong Kong is actually Hong Kong Island is the one with the famous skyline. But within Hong Kong, there are lots of different areas. I think there's something like 200 and something islands. But the other main island is Lantau Island. Then you've got Kowloon and the New Territories. Those are the four areas. So the Maclehose goes from east to west, all the way across the New Territories. And then the Wilson Trail goes from north to south, from the border of China all the way down. Then you've got to take the underground train, the MTR, the subway, across the harbor and finish this last two sections of the Wilson Trail. Then you do Hong Kong Trail, which is the width of Hong Kong. Then you've got to get a ferry across to Lantau and do the Lantau Trail, which is the final one. So it's quite cool because it sort of sums up the contrasts of Hong Kong. In one minute, you're in these like beautiful, stunning natures on this like ridge line where you could be anywhere in the world. And then you descend down into Hong Kong and you have to get like a subway across the harbor to start the next trail. It's really cool.
So who are these people? Who? What kind of people are drawn to the sport in Hong Kong compared to over here?
Do you mean the sport in general or the four trails?
Yeah, the sport.
The sport in general, I'd say, well, it's a big mix. The thing that's good about Hong Kong is it's so accessible. You know, you always talk about, everybody always is quite enthusiastic about trail running. All you need is a pair of shoes and a trail.
Yeah.
But if you don't live close to a trail, all you need is a trail is actually quite a big ask. And it can be quite time committing, financially committing to actually take part. But in Hong Kong, that is leveled down. So there's even fewer barriers to taking part because you can just run out of your door and be on a trail. You know, I live like 20 minute walk to the center of like the famous skyline, busiest place in the world. And I can run out my door and start the Hong Kong trail in about 20 minutes.
Wow.
Which is the 50K that goes all the way across. I've literally finished work on a Friday and just put my shoes on and done the 50K Hong Kong trail. And so the spectrum of people who take part is genuinely very diverse. But I think another aspect of why it's so popular in Hong Kong is because everything in the city is quite fast paced. It's such a energetic city and it's full of those sort of type A people, you know, really driven, goal orientated, out of your comfort zone kind of people. And that suits people who want to like do really well in trail running. So some of our best trail runners here are lawyers and investment bankers and consultants and with people who have teams of hundreds of people under them at work. And then they get out onto the trails of the weekend.
That's kind of like Ironman triathletes in Norway.
Exactly. Yeah. There's a lot of similarities, crossovers there. But then on the other hand, our best trail runners are also, I can think of a fireman and a doctor, a paramedic. I don't know why I'm listing 999 people, but you know, it's not just like cold-hearted number investment bankers.
Yeah. What about, because I'm guessing since you work in the South China Morning Post, so you document everything that's happening kind of in South China, not just Hong Kong, right? It's in the whole area.
Yeah, well, we cover everything in the world. We're based in South China, but we're pretty international. I can see where people are reading us, and the US is huge. So, yeah, I have to stay up late on in August and watch the finish of the UTMB so I can get my story immediately online as they cross the finish line, so-and-so wins the race. Or the CrossFit Games. I cover a lot of CrossFit as well. My title is Extreme Sports, and that seems to come under Extreme Fitness. So, yeah, during the CrossFit Games, it's like 3 or 4 days long in America. Starts at like 8 p.m. Hong Kong time and finishes at 8 a.m. I just sit 3 nights in a row just watching live CrossFit.
Do you enjoy it? Do you like CrossFit Games?
Yeah. I mean, the problem with it, watching it live, is like maybe 2 hours between each event. But if the events could be pretty exciting, you know, like any sport is exciting if there's a bit of jeopardy in it.
Yeah.
If two people look like they might both finish the same thing, then it is exciting. And the more you cover it, the more you get to know the personalities. And sport is more about like the stories of human endeavor than anyone being intrinsically more entertaining than the other. But yeah, I mean, in the recent years, a couple of athletes have dominated so much that the jeopardy is missing a little bit. But it's funny sitting in the office like by myself at midnight, like in August, with my one CrossFit colleague just staring at people doing deadlifts.
So what about China let's call it your area, that side of the world? Do you see any trends that are very different to my side of the world?
In trail running, I guess the thing is that it's they're sort of embracing professionalism maybe a bit more. Like the top runners are professional in Europe and America, but it still seems like a bit of a dirty word.
Yeah.
Everybody's worried that if they add in prize money, then everybody's going to start doping and it will invite all the evils of amateurism will go out the window and nobody will run for the love of it anymore. But in China, they have prize money. A lot of the runners are from these like state sponsored athletic schools where they take in a lot of promising athletes. And then when it appears that they're only going to get a 220 marathon instead of a 207 marathon, they like kick them out at 17. So without much else to do, they start going to trail running where they can make some money with prize money. And, you know, they seem like nice people. I don't know them, but one of my colleagues, a freelancer, he writes about them and he's sort of always praising about how humble one of them is, or the humble origins of another one, and how dedicated to running another one is. And it's not like, I don't know what people in, whenever they like the UTMB keep their prize money down because they think they're worried about like being the custodians of amateurism, and I don't think they have that worry in China. And I hope that spreads to the rest of the world, because I feel like top athletes are owed their due.
Definitely. Do you think, or are there any athletes in China and Hong Kong that are stuck over there because of visas? Because I know that's the case in Nepal. They have a lot of really good athletes, but they are limited when it comes to being able to travel and compete with the best. Is that the case?
Well, it's certainly not in Hong Kong. I don't think it's slightly more open to the rest of the world. I don't think that's the case in China for two reasons. I think the main reason is that because there's money in it, they're not like stuck per se, because they don't need to go anywhere.
Yeah, right.
You know, in Nepal, if you want to make a living out of running, they probably need to go to Europe and make a name for themselves in a big race. And then hopefully that attracts sponsors. Whereas in China, if you're a good runner, you can go around and collect your prize money and then get a Chinese sponsor, and the rest of the world's never heard of you. It doesn't matter. You're still making your living, so you're not stuck. And then once you've made it, when you're making money and you've got a sponsor, then they can pay for you to go abroad. So the Hong Kong 100, which is on the Ultra Trail World Tour, is the first one of the season. That gets a lot of the mainland Chinese runners down. And each year it seems like some runner we've never heard of, but sponsored by a Chinese company, comes down and wins or sets the record. Or, I mean, it's not just one, like the top 10 will be seven Chinese runners that you've never heard of before. And that can be their launching pad for going abroad, or they can just disappear back into the mainland away from the Western media's like attention and live in their own bubble where they don't need us. So. Because there's more money in it, basically, they're not stuck. They can get abroad and they don't need to necessarily, like a Nepalese runner.
Yeah, I get it. What about other things like diet and nutrition? Do you see any weird things going on?
We'll be right back after this short message.
All across America, an amazing phenomenon is happening. With Zip sneakers, kids are getting dressed in a flash. Straps and zippers make Zips easy to get into. And they come in all these flashy colors. Zips by Stride-Rite. They not only go on in a flash, they go off in a flash. Now Zip stickers are available free at participating Stride-Rite stores. No purchase necessary.
Well, it's not weird, but it's definitely different. I think there was one runner, I think it was Deng Gaomin, who lives in Shenzhen, quite near Hong Kong. He's a very good runner. He comes down to Hong Kong a lot and smashes records. And somebody told me a story. I might be wrong in thinking it's Deng. It might be Long Fei. But he was in the Gran Canaria race, Trans Gran Canaria, and he came into the first checkpoint, and he just couldn't believe there was no rice. He said, "Where's the rice?" Oh, we haven't put rice out. He's in every race he'd ever been to, every single checkpoint had rice. So, you know, there's definitely a different diet. And then talking about diets, Chi Min, who came second in the CCC a couple of years ago, he also set the Hong Kong 100 record. One of my colleague, Pavel, who writes about the mainland runners, he was telling me that he just has a completely, like, it seems like he barely eats at all. And when he set the Hong Kong 100 record, he just had a banana. And he sometimes like goes out and just like, "Oh, I'm just going to do a 60-mile run and I just won't take food." And then he'll come back and just smash loads of fried chicken. And somebody needs that. Like, he could get so much more potentially if somebody clouded his nutrition a bit. And on the other hand, if it works for him, yeah, then it works for him.
So what's the COVID situation over there? Are they doing races? Are people in lockdown or
in Hong Kong? We're sort of in a weird place because we never really we managed to keep it under control. So we're into our fourth spike now, but a spike is like 100 cases a day, which is pretty incredible.
That's nothing. That's like Oslo.
Yeah. Yeah. But given there's 7 million people here and we live so packed together, it's pretty good. And the credit has got to go not necessarily to the politicians, but to like the population, because the mental scars of SARS in 2003 were so fresh that as soon as there was like evidence of a virus, everybody started washing hands, social distancing, wearing masks. So we've never had a lockdown, and I don't think they could put us in a lockdown. We have the smallest flats in the world. And I mean that literally. I think per foot, we are like the highest rent in the world. Sometimes it's flicks between us and Singapore each year. So they couldn't lock us down because it would be inhumane to have people trapped in these flats. But we're distancing of two and all the restaurants are shut and all the gyms are shut. But all of the trail races are also off, which is beginning to become like a point of friction in the sports community, because markets are opening up again and people are like going along to do their shopping for a tat at like crowded markets, and yet you can't have a trail race of like a few hundred people spread out, yeah, across the mountain. So I wouldn't like to be the politician making the decision. You're in a rock and a hard place. But there's been no races since March, I guess.
Jeez, have you seen the same kind of trends as people doing? Are people doing more FKTs?
Yeah, it took a while for the FKT trend to catch on, partly because I think the races stopped in March and April. Everybody held their breath for a couple of months, hoping that it would return to normal. And then summer came, and in summer it's really too hot to do anything serious here. So people were training, but nobody's going to go for an FKT. And then when winter returned in October and November, people really started going for FKTs. To the extent that it is now, like a lot of my job is like, so-and-so sets FKT on this. And I spend my time trying to find out who's like, if it really is an FKT or if it's just the top of the Strava list or if it's just a segment or if it's supported, unsupported, and don't want to accidentally discredit somebody who's done something 10 years ago before anybody heard of it. But it's funny, it took a while. I didn't think the FKTs would catch on so much in Hong Kong because, as we said, there's so many races, there's no point in doing an FKT, and all the routes are run so often that, I mean, you're probably not going to be able to set an FKT. The McElhose Trail, for example, which would be the obvious one. It's just, there's races up and down the McElhose like all the time. There's there and there's back and there's a reverse one and there's a team one and there's a supported one. But somebody did set up the FKT on the McElhose and it was incredibly fast. But it's now really, really beginning to take off, just like it is everywhere else. Mm. It's good fun to see.
Mm. I saw on your Instagram, you were in Nepal in 2019. For the Annapurna Marathon or the Golden Trail Series.
Yeah.
I was there too.
Oh, wait.
But I didn't go to the race.
Did you run one of the races?
No, I was in Kathmandu at the press conference, and I assume you were there as well.
Yeah, I was. That's small world. Were you there for the podcast?
I was in Nepal to do the Everest Trail Race.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a couple of weeks after, so... But I was in Kathmandu when you were there, so I just met up with some Norwegian friends that were going to do the race.
Yeah.
So do you travel to these places to document for the newspaper, or did you do the race?
Sometimes. It depends. If I get somebody to pay for me to go, then it's a no-brainer. And my company will sometimes maybe pay for flights and stuff. So in the 3 or 4 years I've worked at the SEMP, I went to Thailand to do a small race there. I didn't run it. I just covered it. I went to Nepal, where there was a Golden Trail series on the first day. So I did the press conference. I covered the race. I wrote it at the finish line. And then the next day, there was the Annapurna 55. So I ran that myself and then did like a sort of race report on how beautiful it was. And then I also went to the Sky. Then I did a sky running race in Yading, the Chinese leg of the sky running championship. That was cool as well. That was awesome. I managed to get work to pay for me there by saying there'd be big names. It was like Ruth Croft and Ragnar Dabats, Zhang Jinjia, who's the guy who won OCC a couple of years ago. And oh man, both of those races, the Annapurna race and that sky run, so beautiful, but so high. And I didn't properly acclimatize each time, but they were super tough and I went very slowly, but I had such
Did you do the VK or the other race?
No, I didn't do the VK before. I didn't, they said, do you want to come and do the VK? But I was there for like a week and I felt like I had to submit a story a day. So I was writing when everybody else was doing the VK. But I did manage to actually wangle just doing the race myself, because by the time the race came around, I'd sort of worked out how small the town was. And I was like, all right, okay, well, I'm going to finish like 3 hours behind these guys, but then I could just find them in the cafe and interview them there.
Because the VK is like, it starts at 3,000 meters above sea level and it goes up to 4,000. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. The highest point of the race that I did was like 4,800. I was going so slowly by that point.
So what's your day like? You obviously write about extreme sports. I was scrolling through the sports section in the newspaper, and there's a lot of ultra and trail running there. And I assume that's because you work there.
Yeah.
Do they tell you to write about this, or is it just it just happens to be a lot of trail running because you work there?
I was employed because there's a lot of trail running. You know, they were like, we need somebody to come and cover all the trail running.
That's awesome.
Now my job has expanded to like beyond the trail running. Including things like CrossFit. Obviously, I write about ocean rowing whenever I can because I love it. Mountaineering. There's so many people doing extreme stuff here. But always at the base and the core is the trail running scene here, just because there's so many people involved in it. And like the whole point in hiring me was, this is now like a community that like needs to be covered on a regular basis, like a sport. Because previously we were writing bits and pieces every now and then, but they were mainly in the health section, sort of a lifestyle, like meet the man who runs 100 miles. You never guess what he does, but which are like great stories. They're not really treating it like a sport, you know, like Jim wins race beating so-and-so by 2 hours, like a match report up at football. So they hired me like almost specifically just to cover the trail running.
That's quite rare. I don't see that anywhere else in the world. I haven't seen any other newspapers doing that.
No. Yeah, there's not.
I was shocked when I scrolled through the feed.
Yeah, it's just like, it's just because it's so massive here. It would just make complete sense to have like a trail running, basically a trail running journalist.
Mm. Did you write about the winter K2 ascent?
Yeah, I was sitting up and like published a few minutes after they did it. It was just a short story announcing their history, but I haven't had a chance to speak to any of the climbers yet, popular people, so I'm sure I'm far down their list.
Mingma David Sherpa was on the podcast. But not after this. It was when I was in Nepal. So where do you see the sport going in 2021? When do you think we can get back to normal?
That's a million dollar question. The question about when we can get back to normal is not for sports journalists, but for medical people and sociologists. They would have a better understanding. But I see the long-term growth of the sport being a short-term friction to do with professionalism, and then ultimately a very professional sport. If you look, you know, at road running, there was a lot of friction. Must be 40 years ago now.
Yeah, in the 70s.
About amateur values. What does it constitute payment? These kind of difficult questions. We're not quite going through that because the top runners are already professional. But the optics of the sport in terms of amateurism, I think in the short term there'll be conflict and there'll be some boycotts when people demand higher pay or higher prize money in particular. Not pay, prize money. That's where the friction will become, because it's such an obvious number that everybody can view. And then in the long term, we'll have a very professional sport, and the sky's the limit. It could be in the Olympics, not soon, but maybe 10, 15 years.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Speaking of the Olympics, do you think it's going to happen?
Another million-dollar question.
Yeah.
One of our guys on our Northwest Passage rowing expedition had to drop out because the Olympics got delayed. He's rowing for Britain. if it does get cancelled, he can go and join us again. But yeah, I have no idea. I think there's been a bit of a shift in mentality from governments and populations. Obviously, as soon as the lockdowns came in March or April last year, sport went because they said it's not essential. But this time round, even as Britain and other countries are getting another spike and they're going back into what is almost full lockdown, authorities are bending over backwards to make sure that elite sport can go on, even if it's in empty stadiums or bubbles. I think that's because over the course of sportless few months when people are locked at home, they began to see the real value of watching it in terms of escapism inspirational stories. So if that trend sort of continues, then in Tokyo stands a chance of going ahead. But I have no idea. I'm not a betting man, so I wouldn't put money on it either way.
Do you think it's because sports is basically politics as well?
Yeah, I mean, well, in what sense? In Tokyo,
like,
or in general?
Like peacocking in general.
Yeah, but I think it's more than that. I think they're beginning to see the value in sport for everyday people.
Mm.
You know, it's really valuable for people to watch football or rugby or cricket or whatever. And that's where the drive will come from, rather than as an opportunity to, you know, show that the Russian athletes are stronger than the Americans. I think that, I don't know. Maybe I'd be naive, but I feel like the days of using the Olympics is like a real projection of your national strength might be over.
Yeah. One more question about the boat. The boat you're gonna row across the Northwest Passage. Where do you start, and where do you finish, and how do you get the boat to the start?
So we start in a place called Pond Inlet, which is the north of Baffin Island, sort of opposite Greenland, northeast of Canada. How we get the boats there is proving to be difficult. Like I was saying before, there's no blueprint for this. So we are really problem solving at every single hurdle. We can get it to Nuuk in Greenland, and then we are thinking of towing it across to Pond Inlet, or even putting a little outboard motor on and driving it across ourselves, which would be its own adventure. That would take a couple of days at least. So that's how we get the boats to start. What was the rest of the question again? Sorry.
Where it starts and where you end, the journey.
Sorry, wait one second.
Yeah.
We'll be right back after this short message.
When sculling was a popular sport to watch, Pabst Blue Ribbon was already America's great beer. It still is today. For Pabst is the beer that has always made America's good times even better. Blue Ribbon has the flavor our country likes. Good old time flavor. Only Pabst has it. Pabst Blue Ribbon Beer. Setting the pace since 1844 is the very first of the great Milwaukee brewers.
So where do we finish?
Mm.
We finish in a place called Point Barrow, which is the most northern tip of the USA in Alaska. So we've got to get through the Northwest Passage and across the Beaufort Sea to Point Barrow.
How cold is it going to get?
Probably not as cold as people would expect. It's not like some kind of minus 40 tundra. On any given day, it could be very hot, you know, it could be 20 degrees and you're in your t-shirt rowing. But then I think we probably expect it to be around zero most days.
Ah, that sounds all right. All right. I think we're going to have to do another podcast once you finish the project. And if something cool happens over there when it comes to trail running or, I don't know, climbing or extreme sports, I'll, now we have an insider.
yeah. You can hit me up anytime you need to know anything about trail running here. I'll try my best to answer you.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks for taking your time.
No, thank you for chatting.
Welcome to Now Is It Outdoor with Hans Olsson and friends. We're going to be the best podcast that you ever did here. We're going to thrill you. We're going to teach you. We're going to entertain you. Like Britney Spears once said, there are those of us who observe. Those of us who are here to entertain.